Any questions about anything from last time? I posted solutions to the homework 8. I thought that was kind of, some of those homework problems were kind of fun. Especially the one about the fake Fibonacci numbers. I had never seen that one before. But I thought one of the homework problems was about the Weyl criterion. And it was to prove that in the reverse of the Weyl criterion. I just wanted to emphasize that back when we were studying the Weyl equidistribution theorem, remember it was that if you have an irrational multiple of pi angle and take n times it, then it blasts out an equidistributed dense subset of the circle. And that meant that the number of hits you would get in sort of a certain interval was the proportion of the circle that was that interval. And let's see, so we proved the Weyl equidistribution theorem. And remember, what we did is the definition of this equidistribution thing is equivalent to showing that you have this integral identity for step functions. And the key to the whole business was getting this lemma about the sum of this sum tending to an integral. And so the part of the direction of the Weyl criterion that's the easy part is when we did this proof, if we wanted to get that for all continuous functions, all we needed to get it was for the trig functions, namely the trig polynomials. It's always true for the function 1, because that's just 1 equal 1. And the key to making this whole thing work was that we needed to check the condition for the other trig polynomials, e to the I m theta. And that's what we were able to figure out in this problem. And so the Weyl criterion says, if I have this condition, then I get equidistribution. And that's the direction we did. If we have this Weyl criterion that these integrals which are zero, then the things are equidistributed. And so the reverse thing is also true. If they're equidistributed, then this thing holds. And that's what you were showing in the homework. And I've written out solutions to that. It's funny how clean it all turns out to be. So the remark was, we've done the if and only if part. Because the if part was, we went and proved this in the case of the things that were rotations. And this was the key lemma. And from this point on, it was all routine. So if this is the assumption, that's the Weyl criterion, then that part that we did falls right out of it. Because then you can get it for continuous functions, and then you can get it for step functions and whammo. That's the result. Okay, so I'm tying up some loose ends that way. The big subject for today is I want to demonstrate the Poisson summation formula, which is kind of a neat thing. But I thought I'd tie up some loose ends about the Fourier transform. We've been using a thing which I would call Fourier integral convolution. It's the convolution operator that's relevant to Fourier transform. And it was defined like this. F convolved with G at x is the integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of x minus t times g of t dt. And this makes good sense for when f and g are in the Schwarz class. And there's some facts about this Fourier integral. This is a convolution. There's some facts about Fourier integrals of this thing that make it sort of the natural one. And here they are. Basic facts.
I think I'll let you read the proofs of these facts in Stein. It's mostly writing out integrals and doing Fubini's theorem and just doing it. They're not very deep. They're just a lot of writing. So one big fact is that if you convolve F with G, it's the same as convolving G with F. You get the same thing. That's kind of a Fubini argument, change of variables trick. It's kind of straightforward, but I'll let you read it. Another biggie, and this is why I'm calling it this convolution relevant to Fourier integral, is that if you take the Fourier transform of F convolved with G, you get the product of the Fourier transforms. That's nice to know. And so, for example, if you wanted to whenever you have a formula like this, there's a dual one, that if I were to take the Fourier transform of the product, I would get basically the convolution of the Fourier transforms. With maybe some minus signs popping out that are annoying. That's it. I should remark that you've seen probably a convolution someplace in your ODE class. So here's a note. There's a convolution that's relevant to the Laplace transform, and it's different. And it's the convolution for Laplace transform. Maybe I'll call this convolution sub L because it's different. Let's see, this is going to be a function of x. That kind of convolution is the integral from 0 to x of f of tau g of x minus tau d tau. So if you think about that, you're taking a Riemann sum, and I'm taking the interval from 0 to x. So let's see, here's a 0, here's x. And as I let tau go from left to right, x minus tau goes from right to left. So think about it, here's a tau 1, a tau 2, dot, dot, dot. Out to tau n minus 1, maybe. This one could be a tau 0. And this last one would be a tau n. So if I'm adding up f of these taus times g of the ones coming from the other end, so it's jumbling them up. That's why they call it a convolution. It's convoluted. Anyway, that convolution operator is relevant to Laplace transforms in that if I take the Laplace transform of F, Laplace transform convolution with G, then I get the product of the Laplace transforms. Where the Laplace transform of little f is big F. And the Laplace transform of little g is big G. So be aware that there's different kinds of convolution for different subject areas. And just when you're doing Laplace transform, the functions are only relevant from 0 to infinity. Don't care about the negative real line for Laplace transform. Laplace transforms are for solving ODEs in the future. And you don't care about the past. So that's why they only care about forward time, 0 to infinity. Another remark I wanted to make that I'm not going to dwell on, Stein doesn't dwell on it either. all the things we've been doing about Fourier and inversion and the rules of Fourier integrals extend to a bigger class of functions. So the basics, facts about the Fourier transform extend kind of routinely from functions in S to kind of a dope, sounds a dopey sounding class of functions, to functions of moderate decrease whose Fourier transform is also of moderate decrease. So it's just so tedious to say that, that it gets used in places here and there, and it's a nice thing to know, but it kind of doesn't tell you anything new to figure these stuff out. The thing is, you always get functions in S, and then approach functions of moderate decrease, and see that what you needed to make the thing true still holds. So let's see, functions of moderate decrease whose Fourier transform is also of moderate decrease. And for example, those convolution facts also extend to that category. Since I'm kind of finishing off chapter 5 today, I mentioned that Stein takes a moment to show the Weierstrass approximation theorem. And you remember that I did that using a compactly supported bump function. And what's neat about Stein's thing is that he uses the Gaussian in a very similar way. So let's suppose, I'm not going to go through all the details because we've seen it before, but let's suppose F is continuous on AB. Then let's say it looks like this. Here's A, here's B. Maybe it starts here, wiggles around, and at B it's here. I want to make it a compactly supported thing, and I want it to be I don't want there to be any jumps. So notice that this line right here is a linear thing. So the blue thing is f of x, and the red thing I'll call L of x. If I subtract off that's a line, ax plus b, that's a linear thing. So if I can approximate approximate f minus l by a polynomials, I just move the minus L over to the other side, and that just adds a linear term to my polynomial. So note, if I can approximate f minus L by a polynomial, then f is approximated by L plus polynomial, which is a polynomial. Then F would be approximated by L plus the poly, and that's equal to a poly. So I can subtract off L and assume that my function is zero at A and B. Hence, I can assume f of a equals 0 equals f of b. And now I'm going to use the Gaussian. Phi epsilon of x, remember, was 1 over epsilon e to the minus pi x over epsilon squared. And the things we've been doing, the arguments that we went through, it's easy to show that f that phi sub epsilon convolved with f tends to f, the continuous function f, uniformly. On the whole real line, in fact.
It's, you know, with it. And so what
Stein tells you that's a nice remark to make
is, you know, this thesis epsilon is a nice power series, can be given by a nice power series. So you can find a power series that converges to that thesis epsilon on a big compact set.
So restrict attention. To a minus m that contains my interval,
and I can approximate my Gaussian to high order by a polynomial.
So approximate phi epsilon by a power series. And you know, the remainder term of the power series,
that power series converges like crazy. It converges even faster than e to the x, because it's e to the minus x squared. So we can approximate.
Do you mean minus m contained in ab? Like minus m contained?
Minus m contains ab. Something bigger than the interval I'm worried about. We can approximate phi epsilon by power series by a finite, the first few terms of a power series, by the beginning polynomial of the power series, which converges extremely rapidly on a closed interval like minus m to m.
And that's how I get a polynomial that's close to, I do the usual routine.
Let's call that polynomial P. P of X very close to that. Then phi sub X convolved with F is going to be very close to the polynomial convolved with F. And the polynomial convolved with F turns out to be a polynomial. Okay, so this thing at X is equal to the integral from minus and remember f is 0 outside of a big thing. So this would be an integral over minus m to plus m of p of x minus t times f of t.
Because f is 0 outside the interval. And then if I write that out and pull it apart, this would be a sum of
x minus t to powers. I'd have a cn's here, and it'd be a finite sum.
And I'd pull it apart and integrate and realize that this would be a sum of integrals
and I could pull the x to the powers out and I'd get integrals of function of t. So this would be a polynomial in T times the f of t dt.
And that's one way to get a polynomial that's close to my continuous function. And it works just fine. Anyway, I'll let you read the gory details in Stein. It's just exactly, now that I've sketched it out, writing out the little details just is a matter of saying epsilons and deltas.
Okay, so that, so far I've just been tying up loose ends that I wanted to state so you can read chapter 5 better, which you should do. But now I want to talk about something new. This is the tail end of chapter 5, kind of a mind-blowing thing called the Poisson summation formula. The same Poisson who did the Poisson kernel in my family tree. And so it's for functions in the Schwartz class, and it's kind of a mind-blowing thing. It says that the sum, as n goes from minus infinity to infinity, f of x plus n, that's a perfectly nice function, because if you're in a Schwartz class, you can bound the outside of a far away by 1 over n squared. And so you can make these things converge, like 1 over n squared, and the Weierstrass m test would tell you that these things converge to a continuous function. So being in the Schwartz class means you can use the Weierstrass m test and see that these converge uniformly to a continuous function. In fact, it converges uniformly to a C infinity function, because you can do the same thing for the derivatives. So the mind-blowing thing is that that sum is equal to a sum of a Fourier series. Now this is going to be a weird thing. This looks like the usual Fourier coefficients, but that is not. This is the Fourier transform at the point at the n, at the number n. So the facts are, this is a C infinity function. And it's period. It's a periodic of period 1. Right? Because if I add x plus 1, I'm still adding up this thing over all the integers. I just shifted them by 1. The sum would be the same. So if I put an x plus 1 in there, I get the same thing. So it's clearly period. If it makes sense, it's got to be periodic with period 1. And this side, this stands for the Fourier transform at, so this is the Fourier transform of f at n. Funny that it corresponds with the usual notation for a Fourier coefficient of a one periodic function. Okay, that's the Poisson summation formula. It's kind of neat to stick in x equals 0 in that formula. Here's the case n equals 0. Not n equals 0, x equals 0. Then this left-hand side becomes the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of f of n is equal to the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of the Fourier transform evaluated at n. How weird is that? I don't know if this has applications to signal processing or not, but there's many examples, and I guess Stein mentions them, where this spits out a mind-blowing formula between two things. So for example, one of everybody's favorite identities is, I like to prove this identity using complex variables. Let's see, Stein makes it an exercise. If I tried to do it from memory, I'd probably screw it up. Here it is. Here's a famous formula. And it's related to Poisson summation. Pi squared over sine pi alpha squared, sine squared pi alpha, is the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity of 1 over n plus alpha squared. What?
Pretty sure we had this on a homework assignment.
You had this?
Yeah.
I don't remember writing out solutions to it. I've given it a homework.
Sure, we did it when we were doing partial
identity. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did I not write out that solution? Well, it's a famous formula. And it's it can be related to just a Poisson summation formula. But this is true for, let's see, if alpha made these vanish, that would be a bummer. So alpha can't be an integer. Then that sum wouldn't make any sense. So alpha not an integer. That's related to this Poisson summation formula. And that's kind of where you see it getting used. This is the kind of thing that, you know, if you're in number theory and you're going to study the Riemann zeta function and stuff like that, these famous identities come up. And they're kind of mind-blowing. And they actually get used in key ways. So it's more of a theoretical fact. It's just kind of mind-blowing. But it has very simple proof. And it fits into chapter 5 real nicely. So I'm going to do it. So here's the proof of the Poisson formula. Let's see, that Fourier coefficient, let's write f of x is the sum. It's a C infinity function because you can differentiate it. The derivatives of a Schwarz function is Schwarz, and so all the derivatives converge uniformly to the derivative. And it's periodic. And so the Fourier coefficient, now this one is going to be the actual Fourier coefficient. So let's call it F hat M. That's the mth Fourier coefficient. So this thing is periodic. C infinity, period 1. And this is the Fourier coefficient that you would get. The Fourier series coefficient. Okay, and that would be, remember from way back, this would be the integral from 0 to 1 of f of x times e to the minus 2 pi I m times x dx. So way back early in the semester, that's how we got our Fourier coefficients. I never had my functions being periodic of 2 pi. I had them being periodic of period 2 pi instead of 1. And when you do a period 2 pi, that 2 pi is not there. So, but period 1, the 2 pi pops out. Okay, so that's a formula we went through way back. And now I'm going to write that as an integral of this sum. E to the minus 2 pi I m x dx. And because of the uniform convergence, the Weierstrass-M test uniform convergence, I can interchange the sum with the integral. So this is equal to, and it's because of uniform convergence, this is equal to the sum of the integrals. So I'd have a sum of integrals from 0 to 1, f of x plus n, e to the minus 2 pi I m x dx. And if you look at that for about 2 seconds, you think, aha, this looks like a shifted integral by shifted by n, and I keep integrating it over and over again. So it's like integrating little pieces of f of x, obviously going from all along the whole real line. And that's the key to see what I'm talking about. it's convenient to do a change of variables here. I would call this tau. If that's tau, then x, let's see, dx would be equal to d tau. And so I've got an x up there. That x is going to be equal to x plus n equals tau, so x is tau minus n. And let's see, when x is equal to 0, then tau would be 0 plus n. So tau is 0 plus n equals n. And when x is equal to the other endpoint, tau is equal to 1 plus n. And so this, to continue, this integral becomes the sum as n goes from minus infinity to infinity, integral from n to n plus 1, f of tau, e to the minus 2 pi I m times tau minus n. D tau. And here's the neat thing. In fact, this is critical here. This exponential, let's see, what is it? This is equal to e to the minus 2 pi I m tau. Times e to the 2 pi I m n. And remember, e to the 2 pi I integer is equal to 1. Just write it out in terms of cosines and sines. This is equal to 1. That's important. And so this, now we see, aha, the n goes away, and now I've got an integral. This is just an integral over the whole real line, split into little segments. So this is going to spit me out the integral from minus infinity to infinity of f of tau e to the minus 2 pi I m tau d tau. And that's the Fourier transform, where the S is equal to M. And so this is the Fourier transform of F at M. And that's actually what I wanted to see. And because this function on the left is nice and smooth, that Fourier series converges to that function. So the Fourier coefficient for F is F hat of M, and the Fourier series actually converges, because the thing on right is nice and smooth. Nicely to F. So that's the proof. Well, I kind of have to decide what to do next in this course. I was thinking when I finished chapter 5 I would be done. You'll notice that when you read chapter 5, I already did the tail end of it, which is using Laplace transform to solve PDEs. I did that using the properties of Laplace transform before I understood the proofs, assuming those facts. So you'll be able to finish off chapter 5 now, reading it. What I thought I would do is talk a little bit about Bessel functions, because they're highly related to this stuff.
and I kind of got, I did the vibrating square drum head, which is a classic problem. If I want to do the vibrating circular drum head, I'm going to need Bessel functions. And so I thought I'd give you the tools you need to understand Bessel functions. I'm not going to go overboard on them, but I want you to sort of get exposed to them. They're cool. Does anybody have any requests for what we might do? We've got 2 more weeks of class. You might think about that and see if there's something you want to think about. One thing I'm tempted to do is the famous Radon transform. Let me tell you what it is. It's the X-ray transform. It's the basis of CAT scans and why you can send little X-rays to somebody and measure the absorption and then figure out what's inside them from that data. So here's one way I like to think about the Radon transform. Let's suppose you have a birthday cake and you can slice it and measure the area of each slice in every direction. So you'd be hacking your birthday cake to bits. So let's say you have an oddly shaped birthday cake. So this is a birthday cake. Then you take a great big meat cleaver and hack it. So cut.
Wait, is this in the plane? Or?
No, it's a birthday cake. It's right here. That's what you think of a birthday cake. So, dot, 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 like this. There's your birthday cake. And you're going to cut it with a cleaver. Okay, so when you cut it with a cleaver, you'll have this slice shape. And you could measure this area. Okay, so for every direction you have for a slice, you'd have this area. That's a number. So if you think about it, if you look from above, we'd have this cake, and then on every slice, we'd have a number corresponding to this slice. Here's a slice. Each one of those slice directions would have an area associated with it. If I knew this data, if I knew the area of every slice, could I get the shape of my cake back? That's the problem. That's the Radon inversion formula. So the Radon transform takes lines to areas. So let's see, I've got a function, which is the shape of the cake. So a function goes to data that it corresponds to lines and the areas. So think of the function as the shape of the cake. That's the cake shape. And the Radon inversion problem is, if I knew all these data, if I knew this data, can I get my function shape back? So this exact same problem happens when you say you stick somebody in a tube so there's the tube and here's a body. And you notice in the CAT scan machine, there's all these little things sticking out. And what they do is they shoot an X-ray across. And then it's detected over here, and they measure how much got absorbed shooting an X-ray across. So you'd shoot this little beam that goes across. And when the beam goes through the body, the density of this, the density function tells you how much absorption there is. So the data would be,
so this is an X-ray beam. And you shoot it from this side and measure it on this side.
And if there's something thick, like a bone in here, it's going to absorb a lot of this beam and it'll come back weaker. And so what you're measuring there is an integral.
Measure the integral of the density dx.
Okay, so, and if you can do this in all the directions, which, you know, your thing spins around and shoots X-rays in all directions, you measure a whole bunch of directions, and so that means you've got this data, which is the integral of the density along lines. Can you recover your density function from it back?
So the X-ray, what's this called? X-ray crystallography? So the big problem can you recover the density function from this data along lines? The density function from the data. That's the radon inversion problem in another way.
Same thing. It's exactly the same problem. I like to think of the cake slicing because you know, everybody knows what an area is. And it turns out that yes, you can. And that's the famous radon inversion formula. And understanding the radon inversion formula and proving it is just using the Fourier transform. It's a fantastic application of the Fourier transform. But it requires a little bit of geometric reasoning and some I could probably blow a week talking about it. It would be fun. You'd understand all the steps because it's just, if you understand the Fourier transform, you understand this thing. But relating it to Fourier transform takes some effort.
So it's an exciting fact. So you know the people in medicine who did the X-ray, what's it called? The CAT scan. Cartography? I can't remember
what you're talking about, but I can't remember.
X-ray cartography, I forget what it's called. An exciting fact is that the Fourier transform and Fourier inversion formula can be used in a rather straightforward way. To get a formula for radon inversion. And the people who did this in medicine got Nobel Prizes for it. Radon was a Polish guy who did the math a long time ago. I never got anything for it. The radon inversion formula, which is the basis of tomography, that's what it's called. Which is the basis of X-ray tomography.
And so if you want to look in the index, you'll find that Stein talks about radon transform later in the book. It'd be a nice thing to skip to and read, especially if you've got time in the summer to read something fascinating. It's great math. I went to MIT as a grad student and took a whole semester course on radon transform from Sigurdur Helgason. It has great generalizations to a lot of different things, and it has a lot of theoretical implications. And you know, there's lots of problems like this. They're called inverse problems. and there's people in the math department who are studying a problem. If I set off a bomb in New Jersey and measure the vibrations in San Francisco, and maybe do that on a lot of spots, can I figure out what's inside the Earth by, you know, how the wave has changed by the time it comes to San Francisco? See, difficult problem is you put bombs all over the Earth and blow them off and measure this thing at a lot of points, then you can start reconstructing what's inside the density of the Earth and figuring out what's inside the Earth. That's an inverse problem. And the math behind it is very fascinating. It's PDE. Whenever you have a PDE problem, there's a Radon inversion formula that's relevant to that kind of PDE. And the vibrations of the Earth, I think it's a fourth order differential equation about the way waves move through rock. So that's good math.
But would it matter for that the outer core is liquid?
That's the kind of problem they're dealing with. Okay. You know? So in applied math, it never everything, there's never anything so clean and easy as slicing a birthday cake without wrecking it. But so there'd be a boundary layer, and you'd have to think about what happens to a wave when it goes from solid something to liquid something. It'd be like a refraction.
Okay.
And the PDE would change, and you'd have to come up with fancy boundary value problems to think about.
Because they do something kind of similar to that when they have earthquakes. They can...
Yeah, so if you... Through there, it's a handy thing, you don't have to set up a bomb that day.
Right. It all like how many lines do you need? Because if you're in a CAT scan,
right.
It could take forever to
Right, that's a fascinating numerical problem. So you've got integrals that give you the answer, and so the question is, how many, it's like a Riemann sum, how fine a partition in my Riemann sum do I have to get an accurate thing? And so the bummer for getting x-rayed is, you know, if you want something incredibly accurate, you've got to x-ray the hell out of somebody. And so the people have gotten Nobel Prizes for finding algorithms which use less energy, which use less radiation, and are just as accurate. So that's exciting business now. Yeah, we should quit before we all get the hiccups.
Thank you.